seminars, okay? And there are a couple of organizations that put them in, but there's one of the organizations is located, I think it's in Sacramento, but it may be Fresno. But anyway, I remember calling them up saying that I'd like to know more, because it's specifically, the purpose of it is very narrow. It's specifically to educate judges. They have programs, seminars for judges. And so I called up, and the second person I talked to, I said, I'd like to get some idea of what your materials are and so forth. And she said to me, she says, well, that's confidential. And I said, well, are you publicly funded? She said, yes. I said, and you're telling me that a publicly funded organization is keeping secrets from the public. And she said, well, just a minute. So then she put somebody else on the line, and this person was clearly more educated. And he did not give me that line of garbage. Instead, he said, what is it that you would like? And I said, well, I just want some information about what your organization does. And so he sent me, mailed to me, some very broadly written brochures, like advertising material, which is exactly what I wanted, because that's all I was looking for. But I just want to get an idea. That's on my list of future research, because I want to dig into that one. But I think there's a lot there that we can get through Freedom of Information Act and this type of stuff that we can really expose it. And when I say expose it, I don't mean that negatively. I mean positively, because it is part of the system. And if we are aware of it, instead of having secret laws, if we know what the real rules are, it'll help us to help government obey the law.
So there's a number one court in the land is in New York. It's called the International Court. It's in New York. And this court is a number, Article 3 court. And judges there fire federal judges. This is the most powerful court. They're all appointed by the president of the United States.
Get me the name of that. If you'll email that to me, I'd like to know more about it. That'll be on my list of...
And they tell all about themselves and how you can use them, and it gives you all the...
Well, get that to me. I'll research it.
All right.
The International Court claims to be the only constitutional court in America.
Yeah, well, that's fine. True. I'll research it.
And that would help you a lot.
Well, it gives you send me the information, and I'll research it.
You got it.
Because, see, but that's my aim here. I just let you know, this is where I'm headed with this stuff. So
that seminar that the judges attend that you were just talking about, which is publicly funded, shouldn't we be able to attend if you...
Well, there is a little provision in both the federal constitution and also the state constitution that there shall be no titles of nobility. So special privilege, the prohibition against special privilege should mean I should be able to take the course.
And pay for it,
of course. Okay. All right. I'm going to do a footnote on this. I just recently came across this thing. This is printed out from a website. And you may be interested in this in the long run. This is not a short-run threat, but it is a long-run threat. this person, a lady... got ill, okay, and she managed to survive it, but she was very ill, and she was wondering why she got ill, tried to trace it down. And what she found out was that in Los Angeles, they have a dual water distribution system, okay, and they have what are called T-valves, and the T-valves, each T-valve individually controls the water that feeds to the household, each household. They are now, on a federally funded basis, all over the United States, replacing these valves with remote control valves. Okay, they're buried in the dirt, but they are remotely controlled, and they can determine which line of water feeds the household. Now, what's interesting about this is that what a neat way to get rid of dissenters. You know, if you make somebody ill, takes them 6 months to a year to die, you know, and they don't know, they're just feeling ill, they go to the doctor, the doctors don't know, they go on symptoms, they don't know you're being poisoned, okay, or having bacteria introduced into your water system. They can investigate it, have it turned off, when they're investigating the lines and turn it on again when the investigators leave. Anyway, I got the website here if you want to look it up. It's L-A and then a period I-N-D-Y, that's the word indie, I-N-D-Y, media, M-E-D-I-A, .org, / that's the little bar that leans to the right, news, that's N-E-W-S, / 2004, / 08, / 115676 .php. Want me to repeat it now?
No.
Or type it on the computer.
This is internet.
HTTP.
Yeah.
Type it on the computer.
Oh, you want me to type it on the computer?
Maybe notepads.
All right.
I thought you did an excellent job of dictating it.
Yeah.
Well, didn't have a problem.
Well, yeah. There's always a problem.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. HTTP. Well, I screwed up. I guess I screwed up. Let's try this again. The caps should not have been on. Okay, here we go. la.indy. Yeah. Yeah, but I'm using Notepad, so or something like that. Okay.
There you go.
We're getting there. Yeah, let's try. Almost there. Of course, maybe when we get there, you won't be able to see it. 28, 24. There we go. Beautiful. So, anyway, that's the website address. So, that's a little footnote that be aware of. I suggest that what I do is I make my own distilled water. And that, you'd be surprised how many diseases distilled water clears up, by the way. Yes, sir?
Osmosis water system.
Mm-hmm.
And typically a set of filters would last me a year.
Uh-huh.
Water started tasting funny about 4 months after the guy was there and I had him come out and he pulled it out. He says, I've never seen anything so dirty.
Mm-hmm.
He said, this is unusual. When did you have your water thing changed? I said, about right. 4 months ago. He said, they're supposed to last a year.
Yeah. Well, yeah, they, and Costa Mesa, I noticed that when you you get a very bad taste on some of these water distillers, you still get a bad taste. And I finally figured out that what you do is you boil the water first before you put it in the distiller. Apparently, whatever it is boils off. Now, they are putting something in the water in Costa Mesa, or at least they did a few years back, that they said was absolutely harmless to humans. But, of course, it was done for sterilizing and so forth of the water. And but, however, they told you, don't use it in your fish tanks because it'll kill your fish. Yes, sir.
Well, they have two things, rather just chlorine gas. It's kind of nasty to do it, but it all escapes real fast.
Chlorine gas escapes real fast?
Or chlorine? chloramine. Two things.
Chloramine.
Chlorine gas or chloramine, which you can't get away from it, doesn't
boil out or
I see.
Eliminate very well.
Okay. Well, that's just let you know that we live in an interesting world, and to be informed is to be, you know, forewarned. Right. Okay, so y'all got this address, right?
Yep.
Yes, sir.
I understand that now the money has chips in it, and that they're putting these RFID chips in almost everything.
Right.
I understand if you put it in the microwave for 10 minutes, or 10 seconds, that's the end of the chip.
Well, maybe that works, maybe it doesn't. if the chips, if it's actually a chip with transistors and such, yeah, you can destroy it. But if it's a synchronous antenna, then it won't make any difference, unless you actually burn it out. But because, see, a synchronous antenna is basically a set of wires of different length that resonate, and when you hit certain frequencies, they'll return back a wave. So that's one type. But if it actually has a chip which takes its energy from the radiation and then uses it to re-radiate a code which is developed by the transistors that are in there, or MOS FET or something like that, whatever they're using for the technology, then yeah, you can burn it out with a nice little soak in the radar. We'll take care of it. just an instant, that's all it takes. Just put on power.
You might be ruining your microwave if you're not careful.
You might have to sacrifice a bill or two to see the right.
I read one article where the bills were actually catching on fire because the metal would heat up so fast it would burn half your bill off.
All you want to do is zap the transistors in there. Okay, any other questions there? All right, well, anyway, getting back to this, we left the subject a little bit, but okay, so you have a research guide, okay? And they have other things like the harmless error rule, okay, contempt, error in excluding evidence. So all these things relate to a motion in limine, to limiting there. So by the time you get through reading Matthews, you will really have upgraded your knowledge level about motions in limine and how to do in the opposition or the opposite. If somebody comes up with a motion in limine against you, how to argue against it. Okay? They have other things too. Writ of mandate, writ of prohibition, power of court to amend and control. So I'm just showing you that the resource is here. Now you have a procedural checklist. Here's things you need to watch out for when you do a motion in limine. And it gives you the scope. This checklist sets forth the procedure to be followed in obtaining an order in limine without making a notice motion. Well, there you go. How do you do it without giving them notice? That's interesting. Okay, for the procedure on notice motions generally, see Chapter 372. And you say identify the facts that are inadmissible in evidence. Consider the facts opposing counsel may refer. Consider whether the motion should address facts even where opposing counsel has not indicated any knowledge. Determine if there's other factual evidence. Determine when and how to raise the issue. Okay, and they refer you to paragraphs where you can read more on this. See? Pretty neat book, isn't it? Make enough copies. Stating the grounds. Memorandum of points and authorities. Proposed order in limine. See? Show you how to put it together. Present the motion orally or give copies of papers to court and counsel at trial, preferably before jury selection. This should be done on the record in chambers with all counsel present. If not familiar with local procedure, check with court clerk before trial to determine procedure for presentation and service of order in limine. Look at that. They always tell you they can't advise you on the law, right? And here they're telling you here, check with the court. Again, check with their requirements. Okay.
So if the clerk argues with you, take that little sentence there, take that one there, show him.
Right?
Yeah, if the clerk argues with you, you're saying take him, show him this, but no, I have a better approach. Ask the clerk what the requirements are.
Yeah, right.
Like,
that's what
you said.
Yeah, right.
Okay? Now, finally, we get to part five, the forms. How to do a motion in limine. Well, you have the basic caption, Superior Court of California. Notice they don't show you the whole thing, but they just make suggestions. Okay, here's the name, the number. Now, you notice this kind of wrapped, all right, because the case number would be to the right, the motion in limine, okay, you have these little, like right up here, you have this little parenthesis. Well, that's supposed to be the parenthesis down the middle, okay, that divides the left and right sides of the paper. And so you put the date, time, and department of where it meets. You have the name, you have the trial date, defendant, these are suggestions. And now, they give you the actual text to write in. Put in the moving party's name, and hereby moves this court for an order, and then you imprint, it tells you, specify, instructing defendant and his court of counsel not to refer to interrogate any witness concerning comment on or so on. See, so I give you all these suggestions. This motion is made on the grounds that, and you specify the fact the plaintiff received compensation for his or her medical expenses from a collateral source is irrelevant, and any attempt to convey this information to the jury would be highly improper and prejudicial, and so on. So I just give us examples. And then you sign it. Okay? And the form of motion in limine above should be presented to the judge with copies to all counsel when making a motion in limine on the record. How do you present it to the judge? Anybody know how to do that? Well, if you're standing in the court at the time, you just hand it to him, okay? But basically what that means is you file it. That's how you present it to the judge. You file it. Okay? It goes in the court record, because every judge, before he goes into the open court, reviews the record. See, the timing, here's a general rule of thumb on timing. This is just general, because you have to check your rules on different kinds of motions as to what the real timing requirements are. But as a general rule, you set up the hearing date 30 days after they're served. Okay? If you think it'll take you 3 weeks to find your person, then you set it up 30 days plus 3 weeks. But whatever it is, you get a date set. From the moment of service, they have 20 days to answer your motion. You have 5 days to reply to their answer. That makes a total of 25 days. And then the judge has 5 days to read the whole thing over. You serve, get the answer, get the reply to the answer, and the judge gets it. That's how it works. So he needs those 5 days to review it. So they review those cases. Now, I acknowledge they don't read your papers, okay? That happens a lot. What they do is they assign it to research assistants. Research assistants summarize it, pick out the basic issues, and let the judge know what that is. And these research assistants are all attorneys, or they're going to school as learning to be attorneys, but they're qualified to analyze the cases. But they don't have the understanding that the judge does, and sometimes they miss points you're trying to make. But anyway, that's the realities of dealing with the court system. Anyway, so this gives you kind of the form. This is how you make a motion, okay? So then for discussion of the matters to which the motion may be addressed, see section 373.12 in the Matthew books, of course, Matthew Bender. All right. Local council of court or local court practice may require service of a written motion with a certain number of days prior to trial. Counsel, yeah, and there's another thing. There's a certain point where they cut off all motions because the trial's coming. No more motions can be made. So that's all in your court rules. I don't know what the specifics are, but be alerted that you got to watch these. Yes, sir?
What about ex parte motion? Can that be done 24 hours beforehand or no?
Well, I wouldn't say 24 hours, because the judge has to have time to read it. He needs at least 5 days. Okay?
Okay.
Okay, now, here is another order in limine. Okay? Another suggested form, I think. Wait a minute. Oh, this is an order in limine. So this is a sample order. So you can go to this form, type up your proposed order, fill in the blanks. Yeah, you put it in the proper form that I showed you on those others. But the important thing is they give you the wording. The language, right. And these are from winning cases. Okay? Somebody won a case using this, and then they took it and generalized it. All right? Let's see what else we got. Well, that's all they... And then they talk about the use of the form. The form in, of order above is for submission to the trial judge with copies to all counsel along with the motion in limine. and memorandum of points and authorities. Counsel should check with the individual judge's clerk to determine whether a written order is appropriate and the procedure for filing and serving any signed order. See? Another thing on your checklist. Now, this Matthew Bender is not the do-all and be-all of court procedure, but boy, it sure gives you some education. That's why I like it so much.
Dell, I noticed he uses Deering's. Do you have any preference in West?
Yeah. There. When you're looking up the California codes, there are two major sets of books. One of them is called Deering's, because that's the publisher, and the other is West's. All right? I prefer West's. The reason is because I found typographical errors quite often in Deering's. Mm-hmm. So I quit using Deering's for that reason. It's good to look in both because, you see, these books that they have are annotated, and they don't all refer to the same cases. You see things in one that you don't see in the other. So the case of the law is good. But for actual quoting, I quote from West. Also, you had a comment.
Yeah, why would you? Why do they have, one Deering's and one West? Why is there two Wisens or just one?
Well, it's called competition in America. Two different publishers. So they are the survivors from however many there were in the past.
Seems like it would just make things confusing.
Well, that's one of. If you want a dictatorship, we can get consistency.
No,
let it be confusing.
That's right. This is one of the disadvantages of freedom. Buyer beware. But if you can find an experienced voice to tell you what the difference is, and that's been my experience, I've looked up laws and I said, "Wait a minute," and I look at the other and, "Wait a minute," there's something wrong here. But it turns out that West was the right one. So, and it happened to me enough times. I said, I better reconsider Deering's. I was using Deering's because I had the actual book at home. I had bought a used set, but then when I started finding this out, I said, "Well, I'm going back to West. They are quality when they come to quoting."
So, other question about statute of limitations. The one thing is called the statute of limitations.
Yeah, in common law, there are no statutes. It's dead.
Okay, so if I've got a case that I'm dealing with that's actually some parts have passed the statute of limitations, I can get it in common law and proceed with it?
Yep, there's no statute of limitations in common law courts because there's no statutes.
Aha, that's good.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing, The beauty of common law, what I like about common law is that it deals with reality, okay? You can get entangled. You can't get back to it. Common law serves the interests of the people. Statutory law serves the special interests of the pressure groups, whoever they may be. Okay? Corporations, typically. Yeah. So, I like common law. But I also like statutory law. As a general rule, it's reasonable. But, where it fails is in the discretion. Okay, well, that was Matthew Bender's on motions in limine. It still goes back. You notice they gave you this little form, but you still have, as they point out, they still have points and authorities, you still have affidavits, you still have notices, that sort of thing. The principles are there. Do you feel like now you understand a little bit about how motions work and how you can use it to ask for anything from the court? Absolutely anything. Now, a little bit, right. Now, a question came up earlier about this idea of, well, how do you find this information? And I want to reiterate the answer here. When you go to, you have a problem, and in your heart, your instincts tell you something's wrong, and you want to fix it, whatever it is. The first thing you got to do is define your own problem. If nothing else, sit down and try to write your problem on paper and give it to a teenager and see if he can understand what you wrote. Of course, I realize that's risky. But right, they can't read. But nevertheless, the idea is to define your problem. And then you go, like on the Internet. The Internet's wonderful. We have this outfit called Find the Law. And they have cases going back to 1934. Okay? And you look up, just put keywords in and see what cases pop up. I do that a lot. That's how I find a lot of cases that way. Yeah, and you just use your talents, you know, to pick words. But it really, really is a seek and ye shall find situation. And because there is no magic way to research. It's kind of using your talents, your instincts, picking the right words to search on. That's one way, is to go to Fine Law, and it's an excellent way. Another way is to go to the jurisprudence books. There's one called American Jurisprudence, and they have a first, second, and third set, I think. I don't know if they're up to the fourth set yet. There's California Jurisprudence. Okay, so they're AmJur and CalJur. And California Jurisprudence, and that's what it says, CALJUR on the spine of the book. You look up CalJur, and you look up keywords in there. They have an index, so if you don't see a heading that way, you can go to the index and they'll refer you to the things. And you start looking at the little case notes. They're little short, they're about an inch long, a lot of them, maybe 2 inches at most. And they give little descriptions of what the issue was and how it was decided. And these are wonderful things, and they haven't categorized. So, and they'll give you several cases with one point. So you go through these jurisprudence books, and you can find cases. Amazing what you find that relates to what you're looking for. Another source is, of course, Matthew Bender. I mentioned that already. Another source, there's an outfit called Witkin, or the book called Witkin. And it has a lot of procedure stuff in it. You can look there. Witkin, W-I-T-K-I-N. Okay? Witkin. Yes, sir?
It's witkin.com.
Oh.
They're in San Francisco.
Okay. Great. Well, their books are on every law library shelves. But do they have access to the data at witkin.com? Oh, yeah. They're expensive books. But, you know, you can read them for free at the law library. Mm-hmm. And you can copy them. You know, so there's other resources, and one of your greatest resources, believe it or not, is the law librarian. You go there and you say, here's the problem I want to get information on, and it's amazing how they'll guide you this.
In Witkin, if you call them, they will say, what's your name and number, and they hang up, and they get back, they check you, and then you ask for negotiable instruments, they deny they have it.
Right.
Then they come back again, they cover up. It's impossible to get in even with the website. It's covered
well,
up.
Well, you do have state and corporate policies, and sure, they realize that they realize that people can take this information and beat them over the head with it. So, obviously, they're showing resistance there. If you're an attorney, you're a little more trusted. One of the things that I found that was interesting, now I took the trouble to become a notary public, okay? And I'm thinking of, I got to do some homework here because I'm really fresh at it. I only had it a few months now, and I haven't had time to research it. But I understand that a notary can make a demand for payment or can refuse a payment or refuse a demand for payment. There's a number of functions in there. And I understand there's a guy around who has made a career out of this thing with being a notary public and being quite successful. So I'm going to check this out. But one of the little side benefits is that because the FBI has checked me out, you know, notary public gets it, they do a background check through the FBI. Well, that makes me a trusted liar. I mean, person. And I can go down, if I need a paper signed, I go right down to the jail, I identify myself as a notary, I stamp with my notary stamp onto the little form you fill out, the visitor's form, they go right in, and I get the signature. Now, I don't abuse the privilege, I mean, you know, it's for conducting business, but I have business to conduct, and they don't interfere with that. They say, you're legit, we know you're okay, because you went through a police check, see? So they just, now I'm part of their team. You know, I'm part of the functioning of the state of California.
So an officer of the court.
And in a sense, yeah, I could be an officer of the court, I suppose, yeah. But the idea is, Well, depends on your role. You know, just you're not an officer of the court until you're in the court functioning. Yes.
Is it a notary public and confidence back witness?